A few key phrases about American history are used again and again without much question. Manifest destiny and westward expansion come quickly to mind. They connote a wave of people heading west from the East Coast, turning the United States from a strip along the Atlantic to a country spanning the continent from ocean to ocean. Our guest points out some flaws in the thinking and in our thinking about the Civil War. An 80-year period, including the war, is addressed in Stephen Hahn's book, A Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. Stephen Hahn is a professor of history at NYU, New York University. He won the Pulitzer Prize in history for his book, A Nation Under Our Feet, about the political struggles of African Americans over many decades after the Civil War. Stephen Hahn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, I mean, as you point out yourself, I mean, you could fill a pretty good-sized library with books about the Civil War, but the context of yours is a bit different. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things about it. One is that as I began this book, I was interested in making the Trans-Mississippi West a more central part of the story of the 19th century, and that, of course, means the story of the American Civil War. Most people who study the coming of the war recognize that the war was a product, obviously, of a struggle over slavery, but over its future in the Trans-Mississippi West, and then somehow or other the West falls out of the story. So I try to do a number of things in the book, and one of the things is to emphasize the importance of the Pacific in the visions of American policymakers from very early on, to talk about American empire as being continental before it was transoceanic, and of a large struggle that was going on in the early decades of the 19th century between the Northeast and the Mississippi Valley over the future of the country and what that future would be.
Just 2 weeks ago, we talked to your NYU fellows, Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith, about the spoils of war, and I hear some similar stuff in your book. I wonder if there's any cross-pollination between your projects.
Well, I'm not sure. What were they talking about?
Well, one of their points was that Abraham Lincoln, for example, was a very ambitious man. I mean, it's about presidents generally wanting to get into war because it would help them either politically or commercially.
Well, I don't think that Lincoln was interested in getting into war. Lincoln was reluctant and for a time, remember, he didn't really become inaugurated until March of 1861, even though he was elected in November. Needless to say, in some ways, like Barack Obama, you walk into a job with an enormous number of challenges on your plate. And for quite a while, his ambition was in preventing war and to prevent conflict between the United States government and the rebellious slaveholders who had declared themselves the Confederacy. Once the war began, Lincoln was very committed to bringing it to an end and over time to securing the authority of the federal government. One of the reasons he put down his foot at Fort Sumter was not only because it was the symbol of slaveholder resistance, but he recognized that other parts of the country were mulling the prospect of leaving the Union as well, that the country was a vast union with still very much of a weak center, and that if federal authority was effectively challenged in one place, it could be challenged elsewhere. Over the course of the war, he did all sorts of things to secure the authority of the federal government and the spoils of war. I mean, he was a great supporter of building a transcontinental railroad, in part because he wanted to extend the authority of the federal government over the Trans-Mississippi West. He played an active role in suppressing a Native American uprising in the Upper Plains in the midst of the war itself. Indeed, the Indian Wars that we associate with the post-Civil War period really began during the war itself. And he began to create what became a nation state, both through the military and through the development of new institutions within the government. So part of what I argue in this book is that we have an odd trajectory. We tend to think that the United States began as a nation and eventually became an empire. I suggest that, in fact, the United States did not become a nation state, really until the Civil War and Reconstruction.
What does the title mean, A Nation Without Borders?
Well, it doesn't. As some of you and your listeners may know, this is actually a phrase, and I discovered this after I chose the title, that has been used by Donald Trump and previously was used by Ronald Reagan as a way of criticizing patterns of immigration and what they regarded as our inability to control our borders. And what they said was, a nation without borders is not really a nation. I kind of came to this title, and again, I've actually written a small piece about this that appeared in Time magazine online. But the idea was to talk about really our contradictory relationship between being a nation and being an empire. A nation, they're right. I mean, a nation is a form of state where, among other things, there are clearly defined borders. There are borders separating those who are inside from those who are outside. There are borders that define ideas about belonging, about political authority. And yet, for most of American history, indeed all of American history, those borders were being constantly traversed. They were being traversed by people coming in and out. They were being traversed by people who had resources and were investing those resources. And, of course, they were being traversed by the American military and American policy leaders. So what I try to, I use that title as a way of saying, in the 19th century, the United States becomes a nation, but it's also an empire.
Okay, back with Stephen Hahn on A Nation Without Borders in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the historian Stephen Hahn, Pulitzer Prize winner at New York University. His latest book is called A Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. I know, Stephen, you don't write the publicity packet, but it says this book promises to be as enduring as it is controversial. What's the controversy here?
Well, I think there's a number of things in the book that are potentially controversial. One is my challenge to this idea of sectionalism as the central axis of American politics leading up to what we call a civil war, not because I suggest that slavery wasn't at the center of it, but because, in fact, I argue that up until the end, slavery is actually a national rather than simply a sectional institution, and that the struggle that is going on has to do with very different visions for the political economy and culture of the United States between those dominant elites in the Northeast and those in the Mississippi Valley who link investors and merchants and planters up and down from Chicago all the way down to New Orleans. And so that's one of the things. Certainly the shift away from a so-called Atlantic perspective to one that is more Pacific. It's a book that starts and ends in Mexico. It's a book that suggests that the road American capitalism actually developed slowly and unevenly in the United States over the course of the 19th century, and the involvement of the state, especially the federal government, was extremely important in those regards. So I think on all of these accounts, certainly academics are going to be challenged, but I think some of the readers will be as well.
Well, and for one thing, you don't call it the Civil War. What term?
No, I don't. No. Yes. There's a number of things I do, and this is also part of the controversy. I really try to use Confederacy very sparingly because, in my view, the Confederacy is really it's not a state. It's a rogue state. In some ways, it's not very different than ISIS. you're only a state if others recognize you as a state. No other nation or no other state in the world ever recognized the Confederacy. And I do think that we have, over the years, lent a legitimacy and dignity to what happened that was a slaveholders' rebellion by essentially buying into this. The other thing is that I do call it a war of the rebellion, which was the way in which the federal side understood the war. You know, the Lincoln administration did not believe that anyone could constitutionally disrupt the Union. And so they regarded what was happening during what we generally call the Civil War as a rebellion on the part of individuals in the states. I use the War of the Rebellion both because I think it captures what was effectively at issue, but also because the big War of the Rebellion was one of many rebellions against the authority of the federal government or rebellions in favor of local sovereignties that took place over the course of American history from its founding, certainly from its founding as a republic, through the Civil War. And these included, you know, Indian rebellions. These included the Mormon rebellion in Utah. These included other separatist rebellions in various parts of the country. Part of the reason I start the book with Mexico is to suggest that the United States and Mexico faced very similar challenges. They were states that had control over vast territories and had great difficulty enforcing their authority. And although looking back from the point of view of the 21st century, we might assume that the Civil War just ended up the way it was supposed to end up, it could easily have ended up very, very differently, and that the entire political geography of what we call the United States would have changed dramatically.
In fact, the way you portray it, it looks like the internal struggles within Mexico mirrored some of the situations politically going on in the United States.
Absolutely. You know, struggle between within the Mexican elites was between people who were centralists and people who were federalists. The federalists were those who wanted to decenter power. The centralists were those who obviously wanted to concentrate it. We had different names for them. I mean, as it turns out, early on, it was the federalists in the United States who wanted to centralize power, and the Jeffersonians or the Democratic Republicans who wanted to decenter it. But that dynamic was very, very important. It ultimately was the Whigs and the Democrats, or the Republicans and the Democrats. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, even at the time that the rebellion in the South took place, the country was knit together in a pretty weak fashion. And this was going to be a challenge throughout. So the Lincoln administration had to keep its eyes on various parts of the country during the war itself, and there were a lot of Southern sympathizers out in Colorado and Oregon. The running mate of John Breckinridge in 1860, a Democrat, who was running basically on a platform of supporting a federal slave code and secession if that failed, was an Oregonian. And
Joseph Lane, wasn't it?
Yes. And Lincoln only got 30% of the vote in Oregon and 30% of the vote in California. And if the Democratic Party wasn't divided, he would have lost those states. There were a lot of Southern sympathizers on the West Coast during the secession crisis. There was a lot of talk of a so-called Pacific Coast Republic. Mm-hmm. And so the Lincoln administration, if it was going to succeed in suppressing the large rebellion in the southern states, had to make sure that the country as a whole didn't fall apart. And when I write about the Civil War, I mean, I start not with the conflicts in Northern Virginia, the fighting there, but I start with the Confederate invasion of New Mexico, because in part what the Confederacy was interested in, since it had no treasury, was in getting hold of the mineral resources in the Trans-Mississippi West and trying to form an alliance with Southern sympathizers out on the West Coast.
Stephen Hahn is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. Let's define Trans-Mississippi West and what region that denotes.
That's a very good question. What I have in mind are those states and territories in the 19th century that are west, roughly west of the Mississippi River, most of which had not become officially part of the United, become states at the time of the Civil War. Kansas had, and Minnesota had, and Iowa had, but most of the area to the west was either unorganized or had been, or basically one of the things that's interesting about the war itself is that not only does Lincoln support a transcontinental railroad, but basically all of these territories are created because it would put this all of this land under federal jurisdiction. And one of the things that's really interesting about the history of the United States is that leading up to the Civil War, most of the territories became states very quickly. But in the Trans-Mississippi West, most of the territories were territories for a long time, some of them for a very long time, because the federal government wanted to maintain control and because federal officials were concerned about the political dispositions of those states. Utah became a state only when it publicly renounced polygamy. Arizona and New Mexico became states in the 20th century only when the political demography of those states tipped in the balance toward Anglos rather than Hispanics.
Interesting. And then you do point out in the book, too, that California became a state very quickly without a real territorial period.
Well, that's right. It's really, you know, that's part of what's so interesting in the circumstances, because the president, this is part, of course, of the so-called Mexican Cession, what was conquered from Mexico, and the president at the time was Zachary Taylor. Now, Zachary Taylor was a military man who was, got to prominence during the U.S.-Mexican War, part of the reason he was elected president, and he was a slaveholder. But he wanted California admitted immediately, which everybody knew would mean that California would come in with a constitution where slavery was not legal. Southerners were aghast at this. But the interesting side of the story is that although California comes in as a so-called free state, California politics in the 1850s is basically controlled by expatriate Southerners, some of whom were slaveholders themselves. So this is part of the reason that when the slaveholders' rebellion took place and the Confederacy was formed, that they had some optimism about forming alliances with especially those in Southern California, as well as with provincial governors in Northern Mexico.
I want to follow up on something you said earlier, though. You said that slavery was more or less national up until it was banned.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like you had the first state emancipation law in 1780, but
right.
It sounds like these laws were generally fairly toothless.
Well, one of the things, you know, you learn when you look at this process is that although many of the states of the Northeast and Middle Atlantic so-called passed emancipation statutes, none of them freed any slaves. They freed the children of slaves, and only when they reached a certain age. And that age was either 21 or 25 or 28, depending on the state or the gender. So that meant even if slavery was abolished, say, in Pennsylvania, as it was in 1780, that it was going to be years and years and years before there were no slaves. All of these states had to abolish slavery a second time because there were so many ambiguities as to the status of people who had been slaves and to the status of African Americans more generally. What we've also learned is a lot of African Americans who were so-called emancipated in these states were forced to sign long-term indentures. So they basically went from being slaves to being indentured servants, although the courts usually said that was okay because servitude was, at least in theory, understood as something that was voluntary. The other side of what we have learned, too, is that New Jersey had slaves as late as 1860. What's more, the fugitive slave law in the United States, which was central to the maintenance of the Union and the struggle over it in the 1850s was part of the process of the Union unraveling, meant that someone who was a slave in a state where slavery was legal was still a slave if they went to a state where slavery theoretically was illegal. The status of enslavement attached to the body of the slave. And therefore, as any runaway slave knew, the only place you could be safe if you left the southern states where slavery was legal is if you went to Canada or you went to Britain or you or Mexico and left the country entirely. So, you know, in a sense, there's no free soil, real free soil, not for African Americans in the United States, however much it was touted.
Stephen Hahn, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Pulitzer winner for his previous book, A Nation Under Our Feet. His new book is A Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. You can join us at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to bring in some other organizations that people might not have heard of. The American Colonization Society.
Yes.
Interesting one. Tell us what they were about.
Well, the American Colonization Society was formed in 1816, and it was formed by white elites, some of whom owned slaves, some of whom didn't. And the idea was, at least the high ground of the American Colonization Society, was to try to encourage slaveholders to emancipate their slaves by creating a colony overseas, Liberia in particular, where former slaves could be sent. The idea then was to not only get rid of slavery, but get rid of black people from the United States. The Colonization Society, therefore, imagined a future, a post-slave future in the United States, where the republic would be a white republic. And therefore, before the Civil War, several thousand former slaves did go to Liberia because they wanted to leave the United States, and they established, settlements there. But the American Colonization Society first was scorned, A, for gradualism. They didn't really have a plan for getting rid of slavery except encouraging individual slave owners to free their slaves. And second, for racism, because they wanted to make sure that the problem of slavery and the problem of freedom would be addressed for fearful white people, you know, who thought, wow, what's this country going to be like when black people are free, by saying, well, we're not going to have to deal with that because black people would be removed.
Hmm. Now, we have abolitionists in here, too, as well. They are lauded today, but how big was their influence in northern politics in the first half of the 19th century?
Well, over time, it was very significant. One of the points I try to make is that African Americans were absolutely central to the abolitionist movement, both as free people in what we call the northern states. I mean, they were the ones who were funding anti-slavery societies. They were the ones who were subscribing to abolitionist newspapers. They were the ones who were mobilizing their own communities against slave catchers and the enforcement of the fugitive slave laws. But also, you know, we forget, who were the most important abolitionists? Well, they were slaves. You know, I mean, who supported abolition more strongly than anyone else? They were slaves. And slaves, in a variety of ways, attempted to struggle against the domination that slaveholders brought upon them. You know, one of the things that's true about the 19th century that really breaks from earlier periods is that slaves in the 19th century knew some things. And among the things they knew was that slavery was under attack all over the world, and that people like them were playing a significant role in ending it. It's a very different thing to be born into a system that has always been there, and that by your lights will always be there, and being born into a system that by all accounts is at least a magnet for opposition. And I also try to suggest the many ways that slaves themselves contributed to their own emancipation.
Now, you point out violence against abolitionists, which gives us a chance to take a bit of a pause. We have about a minute up until the break. Let's talk about how closely related violence and politics were in the first half of the 19th.
You know, that's a great question. That's something I try to do a lot with. You know, we do have this idea that American democracy stood out compared to political systems elsewhere in the world, partly for our willingness to settle our differences through peaceful and electoral means. But if you read the history of American politics, I mean, it is a tumultuous and bloody affair. And the side that wins often was the side that had more weapons at its disposal, was able to intimidate voters. And this was before African Americans were enfranchised. So, you know, it's kind of an arresting picture where it's not surprising that election districts are usually called militia districts, that they're organized around militia companies, and whoever has the biggest following with the horses and guns tends to win.
And, oh, yeah, no secret ballots back then either. So.
No. Well, there are no secret ballots in the way that we understand them.
All right. Much more to talk about with Stephen Hahn. His book is A Nation Without Borders, about the United States in the 19th and into the early 20th century. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Hahn and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the historian Stephen Hahn. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Nation Under Our Feet, a few years back. His new one, part of the Penguin History of the United States series, is called A Nation Without Borders, The United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we have abolitionists, anti-abolitionists, pro-slavery people, and you point out that Jefferson himself laid the foundation for pro-slavery thought. In what sense?
Well, you know, Jefferson, as we know, is sort of this complicated figure who wrote the Declaration of Independence and at the same time was a slaveholder. And unlike many slaveholders, Jefferson, to his credit, struggled with the moral and political challenges of slavery over the course of his life. But after the Haitian Revolution of the 1790s, and once he was in a position of national power, he really became silent on the issue, and much of what we know about Jefferson's ideas come in his personal correspondence with a whole variety of people who were encouraging him, asking him, pleading with him to take a public stand, since they regarded his anti-slavery sentiments very seriously. But what's interesting is over time, he effectively said, look, this is too big a problem for me to deal with, that we're going to have to look to future generations to solve it. And in the meantime, we ought to be good and decent toward our slaves. He was kind of emphasizing this idea that slavery is with us, and we should be humanitarian slaveholders, the idea of Christian trusteeship. And by the 1830s, as pro-slavery theorists were fashioning a full-fledged justification of slavery, not as a necessary evil, something we're stuck with, but as a positive good, their argument was exactly along those lines. They were trying to speak against, push back against, moralizing abolitionists who said that you couldn't be a good Christian and be a slaveholder. And they were saying, of course you could be a good Christian and be a slaveholder because, you know, we are taking care of people who are inferior to ourselves. And Jefferson, whatever you want to think about his attitudes as to the morality of slaveholding, seemed pretty clearly to embrace the view that people of African descent were inferior to white people.
Wow. Let's take a call here. We have Bill in Roseburg on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Hahn.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you. Stephen, earlier you had said that slaves would that were freed had to sign indentured servitude documents. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to point out that that's true, but it's not the whole story. I'm thinking of John Jay, who was one of the leaders in that action of taking slaves and having them sign indentured papers, and then teaching them a trade. So when they were done with their internship, if you will, they would have a way to earn a living no matter where they went about in the North. Also, John Jay, as you know, founded a school mm-hmm. and took freedmen mm-hmm. and educated them so they could read and write, and
right.
also again, allowing them to be independent once they're out and about in society.
So the indenture was an apprenticeship, you're saying?
Well, I mean, that's a form of what it was. Mm-hmm. They took that form in some places and in other places. John Jay, for example, he had an actual school mm-hmm. where he taught.
Right.
Freed slaves were taught to.
All right.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. And the truth of the matter was that there were numerous routes out of slavery once the institution was ended, or once individual slaves had reached the age at which, in theory, they were no longer slaves. Some of them could go off on their own. In some cases, their former owners did use resources to try to further their education, as they may have done before the slaves were free. But in many cases, slaves moved from one form of coercive authority to another. And some of these indentures, I mean, you're talking about what's effectively an apprenticeship, which is short term. But some of these indentures were very long term, sometimes open ended, so that the difference between the experience that enslaved people had while slavery was still officially in place and the experience they had when it was no longer in place wasn't very different. And in some ways, if you look at what happens in the southern states after slavery is abolished and new forms of coercion, sharecropping and tenancy, dead peonage, come into play, one of the things you can see is that they were pioneered in the states outside of the South before the war.
Well, this sort of pivots to a whole broader discussion of labor across the country, because we are talking about the beginning of the Industrial
yes,
Revolution
exactly.
before the war. And the term market intensification comes up a lot in the book. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, one of the when we talked about sort of the controversial aspects of the book, the dominant view of what's happening in the first half of the 19th century is the term market revolution, as suggesting a great transformation, not only in the extent of commerce in the United States, but in the way in which economic activity is conducted, production is organized, and so on. And part of my argument about the sort of long road to the development of American capitalism is that what happens in the first half of the 19th century is that you see the intensification, the expansion of the way things had been done. And only the beginnings of the, in the first half of the 19th century, you have textile mills in the Northeast and Middle Atlantic, which are organized along lines that are familiar to us in a capitalist society. And you do have increasing divisions of labor in large cities like New York or in Philadelphia. But most places, we're really talking about expansion of commercial activity in ways that had been going on all along. And the other thing related to labor is that through most of the 19th century, labor law is governed by the English precedent of master-servant law, which means that once a laborer enters a contract, even as a free person, they fall under the coercive authority of an owner and therefore are limited about quitting, about getting their wages, about their responsibility if there is an industrial accident. The United States, by the Gilded Age, has the highest level of industrial accidents anywhere in the world. And the prevailing jurisprudence is known as the fellow servant law, which is basically workers are responsible for their own injuries.
So obviously, even if you weren't a slave, if you're actually, in theory, getting paid for your work, you still weren't getting treated terribly well.
That's exactly right. You know, it's not until 1935 that, with the Wagner Act, that working people have the right to collective bargaining. And one of the things that is really important to the economic development of the United States, especially in the post-Civil War period, is the role that the courts play in limiting the power of labor and expanding the power of employers. So it's not to say that there's no difference between free labor and slavery. There's a great difference, and there's no, I'm not aware of any emancipated slave who wanted to be returned to what they had. It's simply to say that labor across the United States, and remember, by the second half of the 19th century, a very substantial portion of the American working class is composed of immigrants, people who were Irish or German, and increasingly people from Southern and Eastern Europe in the second half of the 19th century, whose civil and political status in the United States is really unclear. So there's a lot of coercive mechanisms that are used, and there are a lot of limits to the sort of political avenues that workers have to express their grievances.
And you say above the working class, too, classes were remade in the pre-war period.
Well, I think probably the most important thing that happens in the first half of the 19th century is the creation of what we will come to call the middle class, or, you know, the popular sections of the bourgeoisie. And this happens both because of the expansion of commercial activity, and it happens in important cultural ways, because of evangelical revivals. I mean, you know, part of the story that I try to tell in this book as well is the way in which evangelicalism and the associations and culture that is connected with it become really, really important, not only to the sense of self-identity of those who are coming to own factories and involving themselves in, say, the retail trade, but also those who are going to occupy important positions in the state. I mean, one of the things that happens immediately after or during the Civil War is that you get these missionaries and other officials who go down south and who try to figure out how slaves worship, how they understand family life, how they understand sexuality. And many of the standards that are held up for inclusion are standards that had been sort of developed by those who were in the evangelical movement and the, you know, Second Great Awakening of the 1820s and 1830s.
Well, you know, the book really does make us think and reconsider some things that we've sort of gotten locked up in our memories since we learned them in school. For example, the idea of the South that we take for granted today, as you point out, it might not have been viewed that way back in the time when the war was approaching.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we have to sort of remind ourselves that when people sort of thought about who they were and their senses of political identity, and I do feel that, you know, we have a tendency of overstating single identities. I mean, most of us have multiple identities, and those shift all the time. But they thought about themselves in relationship to their family, to their kinship networks, to their sort of local circumstances, maybe in connection to the states in which they lived, although Americans were on the move a great deal. And what I try to suggest is that sectionalism, the North-South thing, was part of the political conflict over slavery and the construction of ideas of the North and the South come in the process of trying to forge new identities around politically salient issues. And, you know, the South, people in Virginia thought of themselves as very different than people in South Carolina or Mississippi or Texas, you know, and trying to create an idea, an identity. And in part they failed because the rebellion and the Confederacy not only was defeated militarily, but was constantly beset with tensions between those who were locally oriented and those who recognized that there was no way they could survive politically or militarily without building a more centralized state.
want to think too about the political organization at the time. I mean, we had Democrats and Whigs. The Whigs mm-hmm. came apart. I mean, how did the formation of the Republican Party or the collapse of the Whigs before it add to the destabilization of the country?
Well, one of the things that's true about the Republican Party is that up into the Civil War, it was a sectional party. It was not organized really outside of the border states. I mean, it had some organization in Maryland and Delaware, Kentucky and Missouri, but, you know, Republicans knew that if they went any further south, that they wouldn't make it out alive. So you had this very bizarre election in 1860, which still to this day has the highest turnout of eligible voters in American political history,
wow.
which is essentially two elections. It's Lincoln versus Douglas in the North and West, and Breckinridge versus Bell in the South. And not surprising that, you know, Lincoln only won 39% of the vote, but he did win a majority of the electoral vote. No one, you know, even the seceding the rebels and the seceding states never said that he was not the legitimate president. They just said that they didn't want to stay in the country under his rule.
There's a whole lot to think about in this book, a lot of reading in here. A Nation Without Borders, the United States and Its World in an Age of Civil Wars, 1830 to 1910. Stephen Hahn wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
All right, take care.